This podcast is generously supported by Themis Bar Review. For more information about Themis, check out themisbar.com. That is themisbar.com. Thank you very much. And now back to the show. All right, all right, all right. Welcome to Digging a Hole, the Legal Theory Podcast. On this podcast, my co-host Sam Moyne and I talk about legal theory and whatever else is on our minds. How are you, Sam?
I'm good, David. I just got back from Chicago where someone who listens to the podcast said, I was really disappointed you didn't begin your talk, all right, all right, all right. And I said, but that's David's line. I wouldn't be caught dead, doing Schleicherisms locally, let alone national.
Wooderson is neoliberal. I think it's the claim. No, it's a it's good. You clearly made a huge fail of planning your academic schedule to go to Chicago in February. I don't know what you're doing.
It was actually a beautiful day there compared to the frigid East Coast. But as a Midwesterner, you know, flyover country, I'll always defend it against your, you know, condescension.
Ah, there you go. To be fair, people in Chicago are pretty condescending about St. Louis, which is where you're from. So are, I don't know who you're defending.
We recognize the real overlords on the East Coast as the bigger problem.
Ah, there you go. I think whatever it comes down to, it's definitely my fault. Absolutely. Who do we have on the podcast today?
It's Daryl Levinson, David Boies professor at NYU, who's come up with a compilation of his classic articles in book form called Law for Leviathan. And it's a very interesting conversation.
Yeah, this book, I can't recommend it any more highly to you, the listener. The articles are classics. The book that collects the articles and kind of shapes them into kind of what I think is quite a coherent whole is sure to be a kind of extremely important book in thinking about constitutional law and international law and law generally. So with that, let's get to it. All right, all right, all right. Welcome to Digging a Hole. We are so excited to have Daryl Levinson with us here today. Daryl is the David Boies Professor of Law at NYU. He was previously at Harvard and Virginia and is one of the nation's leading constitutional law scholars. And this book we're going to talk about, Law for Leviathan, Constitutional Law, International Law, and the State, is, like, to say it's been widely expected and people have been really excited about it coming out for a while is to understate the case. This is one of the people have been talking about for a long time. And so I'm just so thrilled that it is out and I get a chance to read it and that it lived up to all of the hype. It's like rarely do you read a book about con law that is in fact about con law, not about the content of con law, but about like what it is to be constitutional law. And this book is kind of like Hofeld, but for constitutional law, for our legal theory peeps. This is the Legal Theory Podcast. So it's really, really a remarkable achievement. So Daryl, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
No, it's an amazing book, and it's also a beautiful book. So I'll just ask a couple of introductory questions just to get you to state what the book's about and what the main argument is. As I take it, the kind of overarching claim is that there's a kind of law which you dub law for states, and constitutional law and international law are both subspecies of it. So this I take it you consider arresting certain in an Anglophone context, in the context of Anglophone theory especially, because so many in the past century have considered constitutional law as real law and have their doubts about international law. So why were they wrong?
Right. So international law has for centuries been self-consciously grappling with the perception and maybe reality that it's kind of weird if it even counts as real law at all. And the reasons for that were reasons that Thomas Hobbes, who's on the cover of my book, among others, pointed out early on in the development of the modern state, which was once you have the idea of states as sovereigns, meaning all powerful, nothing is more powerful, nothing can tell the state what to do, then it seems hard to imagine how you could have a regime of law for states that would tell them what to do without some super leviathan standing above the state with a sword, making it do the things that law requires. And that problem has haunted, I think, international thought for a really long time. And internationalists have grappled with how the system of law that has developed for states has managed to work as well as it does work without a super state enforcing and specifying authoritatively what the law is and overcoming these challenges of sovereignty, telling states that are supposed to be all-powerful what they can and cannot do, and dealing with the weirdness of states as regulated actors. All of this has been at the center of international thought for a really long time. Not so with constitutional law.
Great. So Hobbes was at the very least wrong, you know, that states are not regulable. And it seems as if you think that one of the sources of this error was a kind of personification move, that unlike natural persons who we all understand are subject to multiple legal orders, he thought the state was not. And so explain that dimension of how you frame things in terms of the personification of states.
Right. So Hobbes's theory of the state is pretty well represented by the cover image of Leviathan, or the frontispiece image, which is this giant kingly guy hovering over the countryside in the town with a sword in one hand and a staff in the other. And if you look more closely at that figure, you see that Leviathan, this creature's body, is made up of hundreds of natural people, as Hobbes called them, real people. And the image is supposed to capture the social contract idea that all these people, real people in the state of nature, get together and make a deal to turn over all of their rights and power and decision-making to this big creature called Leviathan, who's then in charge and calls all the shots. And for Hobbes, once you have that picture, it seems like international law is impossible because these states or Leviathans never did the equivalent thing of all getting together in the international state of nature and contracting to create a super Leviathan.
Like a Voltron-like figure.
Yes, that didn't happen. And then from the perspective of the little people in the torso of Leviathan, they've got no chance of enforcing law against their state either, because they've already sort of given up all their power and rights over to Leviathan. So for Hobbes, both the international version of law for Leviathan and the constitutional domestic version of law for Leviathan seemed impossible. Of course, he was wrong about that. We've seen it. We've seen international law and constitutional law.
So I was hoping we could like ground the argument about international law and constitutional law a little bit. And so let me give an example and see if you what you do with it. So in recent weeks, the Israeli government has faced judgments from two different courts. One from the International Court of Justice about genocide during actions in Gaza, and another one from the Israeli Supreme Court about the continuing importance of reasonableness review. And these are both things that the current government lost or was opposed to. I think that, as you note, the reaction to these two things is very different. One is found as instantly binding. The other one was seen as kind of like, I don't know, in the air of international politics. But your claim is very much that they are very the way we should think about whether the Israeli government will follow either of these decisions, to what extent it means, what it means to follow them, I'm not 100% sure, but to the extent it means they're going to follow them, is like we have to ask the same questions. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And the Israeli pair of examples is a really great one. So, right, like, I don't think anyone expects that if the International Court of Justice had told Israel or tells Israel that they need to immediately stop fighting in Gaza, that the Israeli government was going to go along with that. Because why would they? Who's going to prevent, who's going to enforce that judgment? Who's going to stop the Leviathan of the Israeli government and military? Domestically, the assertion of the Israeli Supreme Court of whatever powers it wants to assert seems similarly fragile. And if the government, if the Netanyahu government, if a majority of Israelis decided that they didn't want to submit to the authority of the court, then I think exactly the same question arises of how these judges armed with gavels are gonna force them into line. And, you know, it may turn out in Israel that a majority of the people taking to the streets is enough of a source of power to support the judiciary in this particular instance. But then I think we should be asking the question of when and why the people who have the power over their government are willing to stand up for the court, and when they might take the opposite view.
Okay, great. I want to get back to fragility in a second, but I first was reflecting on and wanted to ask you about what makes the claim distinctive. So I totally buy that for Americans, or maybe Anglophones, especially if they've read H.L.A. Hart on international law, this is a transgressive claim that constitutional law and international law are fundamentally similar, maybe the same kind of thing. But I was reflecting that for continental Europeans, maybe for most lawyers in the world, actually your claim is already dominant or hegemonic. Like, you don't mention Hans Kelsen in the book, but you're making a case that he made and that lots of people, Jürgen Habermas, so many others have made. What is distinctive about it, not that it isn't good enough to be distinctive in English, is that, like, the ground of the claim is not formalist. It's not about, like, the analytic normative structure of law, legality, or something like that. It's functionalist. It's about, like, the kind of thing politically that we have in modern times with states, and then, like, the empirical characteristics of the law that tries to govern them. Would that be a fair kind of rendition of what's, you know, distinctive about this book?
Yes, I think it is totally fair and a really illuminating way of putting it. So jurisprudentially, there's even in the Anglophone world, you know, Hart's view wasn't that international law was something other than law. It was maybe not like a sophisticated legal system. It was primitive, whatever. Right. But it was, in contrast to, you know, the Hobbesian, Austinian law can only be the command of the sovereign people, the Hartian view, which is, you know, fully prevailed at this point at the level of jurisprudence, is no, law is a certain type of normative order that has a set of criteria, but those criteria don't include things like sword-wielding Leviathan, whose orders are being obeyed. And in the continental tradition, that's been true for a long time in the major current. So the book isn't making any kind of claim at the level of jurisprudence that would be interesting or surprising to anyone who's thinking about law at that level. As you say, it's all it all only becomes interesting at a more functional level. So to the extent you care about whether a legal system, let's stipulate its law, can actually enforce its commands, can successfully solve the problem of uncertainty and contestation by adequately settling, creating some consensus on what the meaning of law is, can overcome doubts about sovereignty. That's the level at which the comparison between constitutional law and international law might be more interesting, not whether they count as law in some jurisprudential framework, whether that's Hart or Austin or Dworkin or Kelsen or whatever.
So I had another question that was pretty similar, which was something along the lines of, the book goes between a kind of theoretical treatment of what constitutional law is and how it works, and a variety of mostly American examples. I mean, it does international examples, but it is deeply grounded in American constitutional practice. And I wondered a little bit if American constitutional law looks more like international law than other constitutional orders. And so for a couple of reasons. One, our constitution's really old and inspecific and hard to amend. Other constitutions look a lot more like normal law with just like supermajority rules. So state constitutions are really specific. Some international constitutions are really specific. They're easier to amend. And so they look more like ordinary law and less like something beyond the state or beyond the current majorities or something. Secondly, our separation of powers gives a variety of actors kind of claims on majoritarianism, including the Supreme Court, or to speak for the American people. And finally, like, states are sovereign and are pre-constitutional. And so do you think the book is an expression of like American constitutional law looking like international law, or is it a more fundamental claim about that all constitutions necessarily? Because I wonder a little bit about a lot of things that we wouldn't even think of as constitutional law or international. I don't even know how we think about like contracts formed by the state or bonds issued by the city of New York or the state of New York, to how we'd think about them being like, I don't know, whatever. So that maybe we might think of it as a gradient. So is this really a book of American constitutional law, or is it really a book about constitutional law as a theory?
Well, the literal answer is it's a book about American constitutional law, but that's in large part because of the limitations of the author in having the kind of knowledge and background in comparative constitutionalism that would allow the book to be more comparative. There are comparative observations that are scattered around the book, but really it is centered on American constitutionalism. As you point out, there are important institutional differences among systems of constitutional law with respect to how old the Constitution is, how specific it is, whether there's a textual constitution at all, how consolidated judicial review is in settling what the content of constitutional law is, and of course, substantive differences in the law, as well as differences that relate to things I talk about in the book, like separation of powers as a balance of power, kind of equivalent to international law. It depends on the institutional structures of government, and so on. My hubristic assertion, which I'll just make on this podcast without in any way being able to defend or back up, is that what I'm talking about in the book is probably going to be true for the most part of all systems of constitutional law, because at some level of generality, every constitutional system is going to confront the same set of basic challenges that come with imposing law on the state. And they're going to have to use the same basic toolkit of rights and votes and internal balance of power kind of dynamics to make that work. So lots of local differences, but I think at some level of abstraction, the theory kind of travels.
Okay, so I take it completely that you're operating on kind of functionalist, kind of post-formalist ground. And then there's, you know, a lot of claims about the way things mostly are. And maybe you restrict that to America in the constitutional law case, but certainly you make big claims about international law and the way it works. So I just want to make sure that these two bodies of law are sufficiently similar on your terms. So, I mean, as you suggested earlier, one of the main claims is that international law's alleged fragility actually shows up some features of constitutional law, which is, to the extent it's law-like, it's still got some of its own fragility. And then maybe maybe the converse is also true. Lou Henkin said states mostly follow international law most of the time. And then it's like the default expectation, at least in constitutional law. But I guess I'm not sure empirically that there's a perfect match. I'm not saying you say there is, but maybe there's still a big gulf. You know, I think there seem to be a lot of bodies of international law where it's a default that they're unenforceable. Maybe they're followed, you know, the rules on the use of force or the laws of war as to the conduct of hostilities or whatever. And maybe public international law is especially fragile. And I get you could say, well, that's just kind of an empirical fact on a continuum of fragility, and constitutional law is on the same continuum. But it just seems like you could have a corollary to Lou Henkin's dictum that, you know, most public international law is unenforceable most of the time. And that's just not true of con law. I mean, there are some examples in which it's true. So at what point does, you know, the continuum break apart when you look at these facts?
Right. So the level at which the book wants to put constitutional law and international law on a par is both systems have to overcome the basic problem that there's no enforcement if enforcement is understood in the traditional state law way of an army with a monopoly on force top down, making people do the thing. But that doesn't mean that either international law or constitutional law isn't enforced or isn't complied with. To the contrary, it just means that the systems of enforcement and incentives to compliance have to work in different ways. They have to work in a more horizontal way, less of a vertical way. They might work through constructivist or legitimation kind of internalization mechanisms. They might work through game theoretical repeat play cooperation and coordination mechanisms. But I think both in common with international law and constitutional law. So the mechanisms are the same, the problem that's being solved are the same, but the success of these solutions is different. Different, as you point out, within international law and within constitutional law, there are some areas in which there seems to be a fair amount of consolidated compliance in both areas of law, but other areas in which we might be skeptical that there's a lot of constraint actually happening in a causal way by law, but also across the two systems of law. And, you know, I don't know how to net out. Like, if you asked me, like, in general, is there more compliance with international law than with constitutional law, or the other way around? I'm not sure how to answer that question. I don't think it's even easy to answer the question of, is there more compliance with the international laws of war than there is with the international laws of trade, or the other way around, or in constitutional law, is there more compliance with due process rights, or more compliance with presidential powers? It's hard to know, and hard to know for some of the reasons that I talk about in the book.
Yeah, so that's where I wanted to go a little bit, which is, so the book's approach is kind of at very kind of before there are any specific content. It's like about, it's jurisprudential or theoretical. It's functional, but it's and one of the things that it doesn't do too much of, except meet the last chapter, is talk about where we are today relative to, it's about constitutional law to court, international law to court, not about the specific likelihoods of enforcement or following or whatever today. And I wonder a little bit about how you think about writing a book in 2024 that is, that some parts of constitutional law may be like, or the kind of these the questions that you're after are less real under our current circumstances than they are under other circumstances. I suppose that would always be true, but I just think about it. So, for instance, you have this wonderful discussion in the Votes and Rights chapter that I'm sure we're going to get to in a second about how votes and rights are both substitutes and complements in constitutional design, and then how exit is a kind of a third alternative, both substitute and complementing the two things, and particularly how federalism provides certain benefits of exit. But, like, how well federalism works at that, that is to say, depends on a lot of things that are empirically different now than they were 100 years ago. So in a weird world where, at least in the United States, which is that, like, in a world in which we have separated media markets, you could imagine a different, you know, a localized representation or a separate people. But in a world where we have national or international media markets, the idea of localized identity formation and therefore the protection of groups through delegating power seems less likely. And you could do the thing for other types of institutions as well. So I want a little bit about how you think about translating these arguments into, like, saying something about today's world, given that, you know, today's world has certain empirical facts about it that are different from the challenges faced by the framers or by Lincoln or whoever else.
Right. So I think what this conversation is bringing out is that the book is pitched at a distinctively unhelpful level of abstraction. It can't engage, like, the great questions of jurisprudence because it doesn't rise to that level, but it also doesn't sink to the level of any kind of empirical grounding or attempt to answer any questions anyone would actually have about what's going on in the world. And that's a fair characterization of where the book is situated. So, right, answering any question of constitutional law is going to require, like, some empirical grounding of what's going on in any historical moment. And there have been major changes across history. I mean, changes, of course, in how people think about their local identity and state identity and national identity, but changes like, you know, judicial review was not consolidated in this country as successfully as it's been consolidated recently for many decades. And that creates a whole different dynamic in constitutionalism, which makes the constitutional system look a whole lot like international law in a way that's at least somewhat obscured when we expect that the Supreme Court will have final say in what constitutional law means. And there's at least that level of settlement. And, you know, what are the odds today that a president is going to say, screw you, to the Supreme Court or to the result of a Democratic election compared to what the odds were in 1800? Or maybe they're the same.
They're coming back into harmony.
Yeah. But I think those
Trumpian and Moynihan reasons.
Right. You know, in the international system, obviously changed a lot too. And the whole set of balance of power dynamics are different. So yeah, everything's different over time. Everything's different specifically and empirically. And the book does very little to drill down into the empirics of any moment.
Okay, so on that note, I want to turn to democracy and ask two questions about it, because it is present in the book, notably in the Rights and Votes chapter, which is what my second democracy question is about. The first, you know, is about Hobbes, who was a Democrat. I mean, that, you know, historians of political thought, Richard Tuck, others routinely emphasize this now, showing that, you know, more famous Democrats like Jean-Jacques Rousseau were Hobbesian. And therefore, whatever his other errors, it's worth noting that he grounds the state in an act of collective rule formation of real persons. And that's just not what international law is. So that strikes me, a big disanalogy. I mean, as you note at the end of the book, there are people who have envisioned a global demos, and that could, you know, change, you know, the level at which the state or state-like governance operates. But it does seem really important that these two fields are established, one with democratic grounding and one without. Comments?
Right. So Hobbes as a Democrat because he was a social contract theorist, or Hobbes as a Democrat because he, at least early on, had a more sleeping sovereign idea of how the people might not just once and irrevocably turn over all their rights and autonomy to Leviathan, but provisionally grant that authority for periods of time, but then be roused at various moments to be able to take it back and have their say again as retaining some measure of sovereignty.
Well, it's not just about provisionality. I mean, even if there's an irrevocable decision, the authority of the state is grounded in democracy.
Right, sure. So yes, all social contract theory is democratic in that sense, right? And then the distinction between international law and constitutional law, which I'm utterly shocked to hear you making, is just can't be right, right? Because for reasons that you, among and above many others, have pointed out, constitutional law is in many respects deeply anti-democratic. So in the same way that Hobbes was a Democrat because we had this mythical moment in which we all democratically, unanimously, whatever, came together and created Leviathan, the Constitution is deeply democratic because there was this mythical moment when we, the people, all came together and created it. And so every time the Constitution tells us now in the present that we can't do things that we democratically want to do, we should be celebrating the democracy of that outcome.
That's what people are doing with Section 3, like literally this week, you know.
Right. It would be.
But they wouldn't do so with international law, which is the point.
Right. Well, so the same complaints that you and I would have about the Section 3 debate in constitutionalism would be generalized to international law. I mean,
okay.
And how democratic is international law? Well, I mean, look, it's democratic in the sense that democratic states consensually enter into treaty arrangements, and that serves the interest of the populations of those states in some instances, and so increases their autonomy. In other ways, it's highly anti-democratic in many of the same ways as constitutional law is, because not all groups have any say in the kinds of treaty arrangements or contracts that their states enter into, and because everyone today is bound by arrangements that their states entered into a long time ago that they had nothing to do with, and so on. It seems similar to me. Not to you?
Well, it doesn't, in the sense that, you know, the everyone, I think, in international law agrees that the basis of state authority is not a criterion of statehood, and so non-democratic states get to be, you know, parties to treaty and make custom, just like states that are democracies or claim to be democracies, even if they have constitutional law that, you know, suppresses democracy. So this is like ignoring your insight that we should think functionally, but formally there is this distinction that international law, no one says it's based on democracy. Its ground is, you know, states in their relations inter se, and to the extent there are other principles, you know, to anticipate my second question, they're about individuals and their rights, not vote. So let me ask that question. I really like the conclusion where you think about a possible future of global democratization, which could change everything, although to an extent it would just kind of shift the level of some of the arguments you make. But I wanted to ask about the pressure the kind of current disparity places on the rights and votes chapter. Because, I mean, we all agree that rights are a feature of the international legal order, human rights, blah, blah, blah. But votes are not. So that's, once again, I don't know. I've suppressed all of that, but you see where I'm going. That another possible disanalogy is that, you know, the rights and votes claims you make work very well at the level of domestic law, but they don't work at all at the level of international affairs, where there are no votes. Except, of course, the votes of states, not persons, even though persons now have rights at the international level. So could you you know, reflect on that too?
Yeah. So that does look like a disanalogy, and it is at the literal level of votes. We don't have votes over what other countries do, even though what other countries do affect our interests in lots of ways. Maybe we should. Political theorists have suggested that, you know, the right principle here is all affected interests. And as long as some state is doing something that affects my interests, I should have political enfranchisement in that state. That was an old Dahl idea that,
right,
of course, at least the people in Latin America should be able to vote in American elections, since we're kind of running their country at the time, their countries at the time he's writing. But we don't do it that way. So the analogy to votes that I substitute is political influence, not through elections, but through the tools of international relations. So through the tools of diplomacy, through economic power, through military power, that's how people in one state influence the behavior of other states that affects their lives, given that they can't vote in formal elections. And then if that, if international relations stands in for votes, then, you know, international law stands in for rights in a more literal way.
So I was fascinated by the brief invocation of Robert Dahl in the book, because I thought the way you were going to respond to Sam would go something like this. Dahl noted that self-determination can never help with boundary problems, because you need to know who the self is who's going to vote before you can give the vote to them and then have a vote over this. And so that you can't use self-determination to determine whether Croatia, democracy or self-determination as a concept, to whether Croatia should be the electorate who decides whether Croatia should be independent, or should all of Yugoslavia vote on it. And I would have thought you would have said something similar about constitutional law, which is that we, it just in time rather than in place, which is what's the right time frame to make decisions that, that in fact it's not democratic because you can't rely on democracy to ground some, to determine who's the relevant constituent part of electorate, whether it's an international one or a domestic one. You need some other value. But I feel like that should turn back on you a little bit, which is that the book is so avoids like clear normativity, like about what's a good constitutional order, what's a good interest, when should states follow constitutions, when should, you know, it's a description of how they behave, but not a, and so a question is like, where could we find normativity? That is to say, the internet, like, how should we think about any question? Like, should the Israeli government follow, you know, and not just like at the like local, but like, how should we even think about structuring an international order or a constitutional system? What tools do we have if democracy is not going to be one of them?
Right. So you put your finger on another frustrating aspect of the book, which is it doesn't actually offer answers or even approaches to the sort of first order normative kinds of questions of, you know, should we have a system of sovereign states, like 200 of them or three empires, or should we have a world state and have to try to create a global demos or the EU? Or when we think about the problems of sovereignty and self-determination over time, how should we think of people as a persisting entity, and when can we be bound by prior decisions made by different people, and, you know, all the questions of constitutionalism and constitutional theory, just to give two examples. And there are many others. Right. So what the book tries to do is just to show how those questions arise in parallel in international law and in constitutional law, and how the resources for answering those questions and the normative debates around those questions run pretty much in parallel in the two fields, but without taking sides as to what the right answers are. And that's about big normative questions. It's also about instrumental and empirical questions what is it that accounts for the compliance in the international and constitutional systems? Is it just a realist kind of coincidence of interest? So because the powerful are the ones making the rules, we shouldn't be so surprised when they're happy to comply with the rules that serve their interests? Or is it real constraint? And if it's real constraint, is that because there's a rationalist story about mutual advantage over time among competing groups in society or institutions or states? Or is it because of internalization of values and legitimation and constructivism? all of those questions, which are, you know, the big questions in each of these fields, are unanswered in this book, unfortunately.
I love how self-deprecating you are, but I also take it that you're defending what you set out to do, and that's incredibly noble. Let me just make sure I understand the terms of the defense. I mean, I want to ask a normative question myself later, if time, but when I've read these articles as they came out and now in book form, they are, let's say, clarifying. They give you a new perspective. They're not intending, as you say, to tell us what to do next. And yet I also wondered if they give rise to a research program. I mean, do you see them as doing so? I mean, earlier you suggested that it would be interesting to know what levels of compliance different legal regimes earn. And after all, there are people who have studied that kind of thing. And it's not clear exactly that this work is prompting that kind of work. Maybe it's not giving rise to a research program. It's just, it's kind of helping clarify our thinking or allowing us in the course of the normative or political debates we might have to, you know, always stop ourselves and maybe engage in the comparison. But I guess I just want a more forthright reason for the kind of work you do. I mean, it can't just be that it interests you and it interests me. It has to be that it does something for us. And so, you know, that is asking for some kind of normative claim, but it's just one, like, why is this work worth doing as opposed to all the stuff that others are doing?
Should I take that question at the level of working as a law professor or an academic, or at the level of the specific project?
I think it's intellectual work. So I'm I'm down for intellectual work that's intended to have, you know, the effect of clarifying things, but I just, then what?
Right. So what do you think of like fields like philosophy and literary
or mathematics or higher math or... Yeah. Okay. What about the research programs? I mean, many of those fields then give rise to research programs. Is the point of this book to do so, or is it like once we've read this, you have to go do something else now because the purpose perspective is opened and now we have it?
Right. No, there's a research program, I think. So the research program would be constitutionalists. You're several hundred years behind international relations and international law theorists in thinking about how constitutional systems of government work and how constitutional law works. And now you have to catch up. And fortunately, you can take the shortcut of realizing that you can draw pretty heavily on the progress that internationalists have already made, progress in moral theorizing about how we should think about the state. Should we think of it as in a personified way? Should we disaggregate to just the behavior of a bunch of different individuals? Should we think of it as a special kind of creature with different moral rules and principles, or in, you know, ways related to compliance and game theory and institutionalism and international relations? What's the equivalent of constitutional law and constitutional theory? What's constitutional realism? We see pockets of it, but has anyone developed a full-scale theory of constitutional realism? How does balance of powers theory relate or not relate to checks and balances on the Madisonian model of the relationship among the branches? These are all projects that that different people have started to pursue in different ways. And that seems like a kind of productive and exciting agenda for constitutional law that might give those of us who are less interested in debates about how to interpret the Equal Protection Clause with respect to same-sex marriage or the Second Amendment with respect to gun control, something to do with our careers as academics and intellectuals.
Yeah, so I 100% agree with that. That's it's like, but I described it as Hofeld, but for constitutional law. That I feel that's I think that's the voice in which it speaks. But I actually wonder a little bit about one of those research agendas. So one of the central claims in the book is that like a personified state is a a mistake that's particularly dot problem in constitutional law, and that international law has thought about this a little more, so that like when we hold the state responsible when a state actor commits a tort, we're basically holding individuals harmed, taxpayers or whomever, for making payments. And relatedly, if we require just compensation when the government takes land, it's not necessarily going to stop officials. It may even encourage them, as you note, from to take more land. And so the idea of personification of the state is a mistake, and it ignores the real merits here. But I wonder a little bit about this. One could imagine constitutional rules that make the state more like a personified actor. Right. So in theory, a democracy is it makes more sense to think of the state as a personified actor in that it is spreading the people who are choosing the officials who are making the moral bad action or they're doing the taking are themselves responsible in some way. And relatedly, there are lots of tax rules that play this role. So, for instance, when a state has a local government commits a tort, in Massachusetts jurisdiction, in Connecticut, sorry, New England jurisdiction generally, we often see a specific line on every individual's property taxes that says, this is going to the tort judgment committed by your representatives. And it is a requirement that it goes to all, I mean, in this case, property owners, but it's a generalized rule, not a specific charge, and that it makes the government more like a personified actor of all the these rules. And so one potential source of normativity that you might think about is whether rules that make it less ridiculous to talk about a personified actor are good?
Right, that's great. So I'm not against personification as, you know, a heuristic that can be useful in some contexts. Like I think, and say in the book, that personifying corporations as if they were profit-maximizing individuals is usually a pretty good first approximation of how corporations behave without having, in each case, to disaggregate the incentives of shareholders and managers and other stakeholders, because we have some background theory of how all of those individual incentives are going to aggregate up to a predictable kind of behavioral model. And I think some, you know, realism in international relations, like the more sophisticated forms of realism, have done sort of the same thing. If you have certain premises about relative as opposed to absolute gains and some kind of homogeneity of interest among the populations of states with respect to some dimensions, like not being killed and stuff, then treating the state as a personified actor in, you know, as an approximation is, you know, a useful heuristic. And I agree with you that there may be arrangements within constitutional law and democracy that could facilitate a personified heuristic that got at more or less the truth in various contexts, like takings and torts and stuff like that. But I think that's the work that needs to be done because, right, as you say, like it's not enough to just start with the idea that, you know, we want to punish the state or the government, so we're going to launch missiles at Iraq or we're going to impose economic sanctions on Russia as if that's going to hurt like Iraq and Russia when we know that what happens is the missiles pass through the immaterial body of Leviathan and land on actual people. And those people tend to be like innocent children. And that doesn't cause the dictators of these countries to behave in any different way. It just increases suffering and immiseration. The same is often true of economic sanctions. And the same is true in the parallel that's drawn in that chapter in the book is with constitutional law and liability, where, you know, police engage in brutality and violence and violate the Constitution. And the way we punish the police and the government for that behavior is by defunding public schools and public housing in the same communities where the people are being abused by the police. And we think we've done something great, and we haven't. We've just made the problem worse. But you're suggesting solutions to that problem. And that's great. I mean, that would be, you know, a productive and even possibly Moyne responsive research agenda that could conceivably come out of at least that part of the project.
Okay, so the last question I ask is going to be my obligatory leftish question. But you've made that kind of question, which is about the normative or political, seem a little bit unfair. I'm going to ask it all the same on the grounds that, well, the book has to be, you know, talking about forms of law that have, you know, at least some kind of authority in our world. And of course, both of the forms of law that you talk about as law for states do. And yet, maybe non-state actors are more powerful in our world. Maybe they always were, maybe they've become more so. But in the age of central bankers and international financial institutions, you mentioned corporate leviathans in the conclusion, but maybe just thinking about the law for states, we have to see it as actually an instrument of these non-state forces. Maybe back to the beginning, Phil Stern, a great historian, has referred to company states in at the time of, if not Hobbes, then shortly after. And so maybe the efficacious kind of law at and law for states so is really about the disciplining of public authority for the sake of international economic interests that are fundamentally private and aren't being subjected to law for states. So you see where I'm going. I mean, what would, if any of that were true, would it suggest that we need a kind of, you know, book that's more like the law for non-state, the not law for non-states that, you know, actually rule the world? Or what would it suggest to the extent it is a credible picture?
Yeah. So if I wanted to pitch the book to someone whose primary interest was sticking it to neoliberalism, I think they're.
I don't know anyone like that. David, you're not like that. You're like,
I mean, sticking it to it, repping for it. There you go.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think there's useful stuff in the book from that perspective. So there's the idea that maybe something has gone off the rails in constitutional law when we care fundamentally about the balance of power in society, and we live in a society in which economic elites and businesses seem to have the entirety of the democratic power, if you believe recent political science evidence about whose opinions actually affect policy outcomes. Why doesn't that register as a constitutional problem? And I think it doesn't register as a constitutional problem for a set of reasons that can be illuminated by the comparison to international law, because the right way to do balance of power theory in constitutionalism is not at the level of Congress and the Supreme Court. It's at the level of like groups in society, such as the rich and the poor. The reason that economic inequality doesn't register in the domain of constitutional rights is because we've cast rights as these individualistic entitlements not to be harmed in discrete tort-like ways by government. So when government takes your property without compensation, that's a constitutional rights violation. But when government fails to address sweeping economic inequality, that's not a constitutional rights problem at all. And I think that's a sort of transposition of a personalized morality to the state in a way that probably doesn't make a lot of sense, and that's been criticized by internationalists in a bunch of contexts. And then, you know, back to balance of power, there's, you know, in the international balance of power scheme, we understand that balance of power is a good way, maybe if it works in the realist model of protecting states against one another, but it does nothing for groups that don't control the power of states. And it does nothing when states can cooperate or collude because states are driven in common by economic elites who are happy to sell out much of their populations. And that leads to international governance arrangements that serve the benefits of elites, but not the benefits of the masses. And then, you know, finally, there's the problem of what we do about corporate power when states as leviathans can't control it, because multinational corporations don't reside in any one state, because anytime they're regulated, they can flee to a different state and they're a race to the bottom problems, because they're coordination problems among states in attempting to regulate them. And that's where the final chapter of the book tries to sort of salvage the project for those who are skeptical that the state is really the main concern in the modern world, by pointing out ways in which the regimes and tools we've developed to govern states might be useful in governing these state-like economic leviathans, multinational corporations, big tech, Facebook, and so on. So, you know, we should be inspired by Facebook's Constitution and Supreme Court to perhaps think more broadly and deeply about the ways tools that have been used to control states internationally and constitutionally might be transposed to that setting.
So two things on that. First, I'm taking away both of your invitations to Davos. No skiing for you. No invitation to the Shell. Secondly, as the author of a new article called Private Supreme Courts about the Facebook Supreme Court and about how it might apply to that most important of social institutions, the NBA, I highly endorse that call. I have one last question that actually follows on pretty nicely. So I love the separation of powers chapter, and the power for listeners who haven't read the book, who I feel sorry for you listeners. The argument is that American separation of powers makes no sense because separation of powers is an idea built around balancing interests in a mixed system of government or in a consociational system. But the U.S. system doesn't have that. And so, like, there's not obvious why we'd want to balance power between the House or the president. What's supposed to be balanced is not clear. But I wondered a little bit if you might turn it back on international relations a little bit. So one of the kind of enduring facts about American separation of powers, to the point that you and Rick Pildes make and that you mentioned in the book, which is that separation of powers only plausibly works when the institutions are separated by political parties, because that actually defines the micro-interests of politicians, which is important to the micro-interests of politicians. But I wonder a little bit about the balance of powers. The balance of powers is an idea that generated over a few different periods of time, but in a kind of most classic formation, which is designed to deal with the particular problems of European countries in the concert of Europe period, maybe a few other periods as well, Thucydides and all that. But I wonder a little bit about whether you could make the same type of idea formation moves you make in and incentive moves you make in separation of parties, not power, about international relations. That is to say, like, does it matter that the U.S. and EU are balanced one another? Well, there are institutions inside each of them that are ideologically forming their preferences. You know, we have nationalisms in both, and we have internationalisms in both. Similarly, you know, you could across, you know, the balance of power is like an incoherent concept in a world where we have international discourse. Maybe it always was. So is that, like, what do you think?
Right. So for most of the book is just about, you know, what international law and international relations can teach constitutionalists. But there are a couple points where there may be some rebalancing of trade, at least in small ways. And I think you put your finger on one of them. So if we think that what matters about relations among states is how those relations benefit people who live in those states and different groups of people who live in those states, then there's no reason to think that balancing power at the level of states is going to do any good for groups of people under circumstances in which those groups don't align and their interests don't align with the interest of the state that's being furthered internationally by whoever the leaders of the state are. So one example is the one I gave to Sam about, you know, if you believe that, the international economic and trade system has been captured by transnational coalitions of multinational corporations and economic elites, then balancing power is going to work the same way that, you know, it does in the constitutional system when the president and Congress are all Republicans. It's just going to be collusion and not any kind of checks and balances or compromise or protecting minorities or anything like that. And then you rightly suggest that there are other ways in which the interests of groups in different states may be more aligned with one another than the interests of those groups are aligned with whatever the predominant, you know, governing coalition is at any given time in their state. And I think that's also worth exploring. You know, at some level, this is, you know, the explanation for why, like, states are trading with each other instead of engaging in mercantilism and perpetual war and stuff like that, because, you know, there are benefits to their economic benefits. They're shared by groups that have interests aligned across state lines. So, right, I think that's an interesting critique of realist balance of power theory that grows out of seeing those same dynamics happening in constitutional systems.
Well, this was a wonderful conversation, and it's a really, really, really terrific book. I feel like it should be like a before you take con law, you should think about what it is that con law is. In order to do that, you have to read this book. So, Darrell Levinson, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Terrific.